Free audio post-production by Alphonic.com.
You know, people get fired in meetings. I don't want to work at a company that people go in at 9 in the morning, leave at 5 in the evening, take 25 days of annual leave.
When we are thinking solo GPs and investors who are building their own funds, we have to think about Finn Murphy. He's definitely one of the names coming up all the time talking to great founders.
If you join Google in the first 1,000, if you join Facebook in the first 1,000, you did unbelievably well.
Because he's doing the job in the trenches. Everybody's like, hey, he's helping me so much.
Because they're like, oh, you're not coming in here being like, I know all of the answers. I'm just like, hey, I'm trying to figure it out at the same time as you are.
Unicorn Bakery co-host Mike Malko sat down with Finn talking about building Nebular and then also his new fund that's coming up. A lot of insights that Mike will discuss with Finn.
If you're trying to sell the company and you like are in this situation and you're like, I need someone to write for us, you know that I'm not going to distribute that amongst the rest of the team and people are going to trade it for gossip.
That we are having here on the Unicorn Bakery from one of the best solo GPs out there in the world. You're listening to the Unicorn Bakery. My name is Fabian Tausch. Have fun listening to this episode with Finn and Mike.
Hey, Finn. How are you doing?
Hey, Mike. Doing great. Thanks for having me on the podcast.
Good to have you here. So maybe just as a very quick explanation of everyone of what you're doing. You're the GP of a VC called Nebular. Mm-hmm. You have invested both in Europe and in the US, and you're usually pretty early. But I would love to hear from you if you had to explain Nebular to someone just in a couple of sentences. What would you say?
Yeah, I think, well, Nebular, so I'm based in New York City. Nebular Fund 1 is a $30 million, like, first, like, pre-seed and seed, lead and co-lead check fund. And where I try to aim to be is, like, finding founders, building in categories that are sort of, like, call it, like, 18 months ahead of where I think the rest of the venture market is. And so that's the whole goal I have with Nebular, is like trying to figure out where the smartest people are spending their time ahead of where all the noise is. And, you know, in Fund 1, that took me everywhere from like space-based data centers to AI companion teddy bears for kids through to like quantum computing and its impacts on cryptography. I think the reason I do that is because it's really challenging when something is like of the moment. Because there's a lot of people trying to start companies in it, and breaking out to all that noise can be pretty challenging. And I think there's a lot of venture firms that already serve those kind of founders pretty well. And my reason to exist is to serve the founders that are building a little bit ahead of that, and to help them be ready for when the rest of the market realizes what they're doing is going to be really impactful and really interesting.
Yeah, that makes sense. And I think your background is also in math and engineering, right? So you have a more fundamental foundation than some other people might have, because like not everyone can look at space companies and figure out this might be what the market is like at 18 months from now. Why would you say that you're a good person to have like an understanding of what's actually going to happen like 2 years from now?
I think like since I was like a kid, basically, like my dad was Air Force pilot. Like I was always interested in engineering and technology. Like my mom like wrote a letter to NASA when she was a kid growing up in Mexico to like ask to become a female astronaut, which they at the time they replied being like, there are no female astronauts. And so I like grew up in like not an entrepreneurial house, but like a sort of like engineering performance, like just curiosity and creativity driven household. And, you know, I studied math and mechanical engineering, and like I did a, like technically my degree is a minor in manufacturing engineering, because like weirdly when I was in college, I was like, I don't want to close any doors on myself. Like I was like, if I studied law, I'd probably have to be a lawyer. While if I studied math and mechanical engineering, I could probably do whatever I want. And that like led me to like not actually being involved in engineering or math. Like I started a software company while I was in college focused on digital identity. You know, we ended up like turns out like selling software to universities is like not an amazing business. And so we got actually hired by a consumer fintech. And that was like really interesting. I was got to run growth marketing there for a while, also get exposed to a whole bunch of different ideas. And then when I left there, I joined a venture firm mainly focused on enterprise software in Europe called Thumbline Ventures. And I sort of, you know, enterprise software was like not the thing that you would have thought I would have been signed up for. And I suppose like when I started, I think like the first investment I brought in the door was an African neobank. So it was like not exactly aligned to what I was hired to do. But I find there's a lot of like joy and interest in like connecting dots and like trying to stay on top of different technical trends. And you know, I think a lot of the like great software companies have kind of come from like counterculture movements, you know, whether it was like Apple, whether it's NVIDIA, whether it's like Airbnb. And I think like trying to, I just find it more interesting to try to find like, where are these people who are working on things where they don't necessarily care that no one else is spending time on just yet. And, you know, that's a different style of investing to say, there's this like quote from one of the benchmark GPs called Matt Kohler about like, the job of a venture capitalist is not to predict the future. It's to see the present very clearly. And like, one of the things that I've realized about VC podcasts and VC quotes is that advice is for them specifically. It's not for everyone. And yeah. So like, yeah, if you're benchmark, you can afford to wait until the present is very clear and you can lead the Series A in that company at the moment. But if you're running a strategy to be one of the first checks in or at the preceding seed, you have to take risk. And that risk that I like taking is like, where are these smart people going and spending their time? And that's it. Like, it's, you're just always on this like kind of like intellectual curiosity driven approach. And like, I don't know if you saw this like on my Twitter, like the pinned tweet on my Twitter is like, VCs invest in things that they don't understand all the time. And like me kind of being like, oh no. And it's like the conversations I try to have with founders, like when I was learning about quantum computing and like I was getting more involved in like the Bitcoin crypto community, you just come at it from a place of curiosity and like you're trying to learn. And I'll always say to founders, it's like, look, I'm never going to know more than you will about your product or your market or your customers. Like, I don't think that's the job of an early stage VC. Like, the thing that I know a lot about is like how things go and how things play out once you actually start the business and when you get into it. But I see myself as more of a like student and someone who learns from founders rather than someone who can be like, oh, let me tell you how to be more successful in this market. And again, because I think there's lots of people that can do that as companies scale, but I don't necessarily think it's what's needed when you're doing these like first rounds of funding.
Yeah, that makes sense. One of the questions that I was wondering about is, where do you find these people, right? Like, I mean, there's like great universities where smart people congregate. You might find like specific subcultures of, for example, people who are really deep into quantum computing, or crypto is its own like large bubble with lots of like smaller bubbles inside, right? So like, do you have like a preferred way of Do you have the industry first, or do you meet the founders first? Like, how are you meeting all these people who are working on these counterculture movements?
It's like a great point, because like, so when I was raising my first fund, it was like, okay, so you're European, but you just moved to New York, but you're investing all across the US and all across Europe at pre-seed and seed. And I was like, yes. So that's like the investable universe is so big. And so like, when you're doing like early check and like first check investing, seed investing, it's still all down to like, are the founders amazing? Like, you know, the market tailwinds are going to be really beneficial. Like, the product selection is like, it's always going to change and what they build, and like, there's going to be pivots along the way. But like, the reason why I try to look at these trends is they just help me narrow the scope of things that I'm looking at any point in time. And like, I think, you know, Mike, like you've sent me some stuff in the past that just been like, that's just not an area where I'm spending time at the moment. And it's otherwise because like, there's always more founders you can meet and venture when I have this wide viewpoint. And I use these trends to try to just like narrow that scope down, because then it becomes kind of self-compounding. So when I started the fund 2.5 years ago, I thought there was a bunch of interesting macro trends that would make it interesting for healthcare, like particularly healthcare back office and healthcare IT businesses, to really scale. You know, I made an investment in a company called Anterior that started to really break out and accelerate, and they raised their CMB within like 12 months of each other. And then that became compounding within other healthcare founders, because they're like, oh, you did Anterior. And then I invested in this other healthcare business called Teton that, again, like, you know, basically Plural came into it, like business started to do really well. And you sort of like, within that scope, I started to meet all of these better and like high quality founders, you know, and that was like 2.5 years ago. And I sort of played that out and I've made like 7 investments in healthcare. But now I'm like, healthcare is super consensus, loads of teams building in it. And it's not that I'm not like taking meetings at all, but it's just harder to find those like unique people when there was less noise. And so, like, I've spent a bunch of time looking at, like, interesting applications of, like, edge computing for AI. I'm spending more time in, like, vertical applications of robotics. And again, you know, one turns to another. You have a co-investor who you bring into one investment, and then they're like, oh, Finn, you should meet this other team. And that's sort of where these strategies, like, compound beyond just, like, the individual investments. But it's hard. Like, you know, when I was raising my fund one, it was kind of like a tricky proposition. Because people were like, so what are you going to invest in? I was like, I don't know. Like, you know, I might do a lot of health. You know, I might do healthcare. I think it's interesting. I think manufacturing is also really interesting. And I think, you know, as I head up to future funds, to similar proposition, it's like, can I guarantee what I'm going to invest in fund two? No, because it's all about finding like where these trends are going and where these founders are. Like, I think it was a very funny example. There was like one investor who passed because he was like, oh, I think your fund one, like it's a little bit too down the middle for us. And then I met up with him in December and he's like this Dutch guy. And he was like, Fiend, you didn't tell me you were going to invest in like space data science and like AI tech and like robots in store. Like, this is so good. And I'm like, well yeah, like
you didn't know.
How could I have known what I was going to invest in? And that's sort of, you know, and like everyone has to do the thing that works for them, but I found like that's the thing that like works for me. And I think with founders that I end up working with, it resonates because they're like, oh, you're not coming in here being like, I know all of the answers. I'm just like, hey, I'm trying to figure it out at the same time as you are.
Yeah. And I think one of the things that you just mentioned is something that many founders don't think about that much. And it is that VCs also have to fundraise, right? So like, half of the, like, it depends on, like, the time. Like, are you raising the fund right now or not? But, like, a big portion of a successful VC's, especially, like, a GP's job, is to actually get money to actually then invest it in the founders, right? So, you are a solo GP, right? So, you do basically everything on your own, more or less, right? So, how do you split up the time between making sure that your founders are happy, that your LPs are happy, and then also thinking about the future, specifically because you're very involved with some of the companies as well, right? So how do you prioritize the tasks? It's probably the shorter way to phrase the question.
That's a good question. I think, like, this is, like, when I was learning, kind of, like, it was, like, I started venture in April 2018, and my intention was like, I'm going to do this for like 18 to 24 months, and then I'm going to leave and start a company. And it was about like 18 months in, I was in San Francisco, or maybe not, like less than 18 months in, I was in San Francisco for YC Demo Day, and I went and met a really senior GP since retired, Jordan Andreessen. And I was just talking about, like, you know, he had been an operator at WC. I was trying to make a decision of like, I really like the job, but like, should I stay in it forever? And, you know, he kind of laid out, like, there are many, many different ways to be a successful investor. Like, there's, like, every shape and size. Like, you know, people that are super social, people that never speak to anyone, people that only do growth, people that only do first check. Like, there's all of these flavors, but, like, we kind of broke it down that, like, there's really five jobs of an investor. There's, like, can you source investments? Can you decide on which investments to try to invest in? Can you win those investments that you want to invest in? Can you support those companies so that you can build referenceability with those founders? So in the future, you can also win more deals and those companies can be as large as they can possibly be. And then the last one is like, can you build a business of a venture firm? And the last one is like very different because the first four are like, are you a good investor? And the fifth one is, are you good at the business of investing? And it's kind of like the difference between being a founder and being like an early employee. Like being an early employee, you actually may end up doing like almost everything the founder does.
Yeah.
You know, you're going to be in sales calls. You're going to be helping out on product. But there's like one thing you don't do. And it's the ultimate, like, if you don't do something, it's not that nothing happens. It's that the founders have to pick it up. And I kind of think of it on the firm management side of things is like, when I raised Fund One, had no idea how to raise money from LPs. And in retrospect, I wish I had just treated it more like raising money for a company because it's very similar. You would think the dynamics would be very different, but the dynamics are much, much more alike than you would imagine. And the way I sort of try to treat the whole thing is the most important part of the job is like, can you win in the best companies that you actually find? And like everything else is sort of just feeding into that. Like being able to support them is really just feeding into, are you able to win? Because when these things, and you know this, it's like when things get competitive, if a founder calls you and they're like, Finn is the only person I would work with, like that is why you should take their money. Like that's the powerful thing. If you're competing against a brand or competing against someone who's been doing this for a much longer time. And then it's like, can you see enough things? It's like, can you see enough to put yourself in the position where you, there's stuff that you actually want to do that you can win? And so everything else is important, but it like all feeds into this, like at the moment of deciding you want to do something, can you actually make it happen? And so I try to balance everything against that and like almost be able to drop everything at a moment's notice. If you have like, you know, one of those calls or one of those meetings or like where it's like, oh, wow, this is actually the thing I want to go and pursue. But that's like very hard when you're solo because there can be stuff that's, you know, like, and I feel bad, like we've rescheduled this podcast twice because like, this is important for me because it's like, you know, you want to be able to have conversations. You want people to have a reference point to know what you're like. But if there's like a company that you really want to pursue and you really want to chase, it's like, actually, that's the only thing that matters. And so it's honestly just like managing my time so that I can do that. And that's like thinking about fundraising more strategically, thinking about like where I source things more strategically, and also like just being able to support portfolio companies after I invest more strategically. But that's kind of the sort of like founder of a VC firm, like how I end up having to think about it.
Yeah, there's always like a little bit of a difference between like at larger firms at a GP and a like normal partner level even, right? Most of the like the GPs have to actually run the business of the venture firm, as you said, and then the partners sometimes contribute but mostly focus on the actual four things that you mentioned, right? Investing. And in your case, you do it all. You do it all at once. And then you're also the whole support team for the founder, which also makes it very powerful though, right? Because the founder just has to trust in you. They don't have to trust in anyone else on the team. Like you are the package that they sign up with, which has some disadvantages, but I would argue it's also a major advantage because there's nothing hidden. It's just you in like your full form. And that's, I think, one of the things why sometimes working with the right solo GP can be extremely empowering because you just know that you built this relationship and you work on like a similar level together for the next, hopefully, like 10 plus years.
Oh, totally. I mean, I kind of think about it like the second I'm in a competition on customer intros with Andreessen Horowitz, like I'm fucked. Like,
yeah.
You know, it's like, I almost like just say that to founders up front where it's like, look, like, you know, I'm not going to be the firm that are going to send you the most engineering candidates. I'm not going to be the firm that are going to send you the most leads. But also, like, you're going to have to figure out how to build a hiring pipeline. And you're going to have to figure out how to build demand and run top of funnel. And I'm like, I've done that before. And I'm happy to have those conversations with you and be in the trenches with you. And, like, be the person that you don't have to be worried about, like, performing for. Because you don't know what that person, like how much of their career is on the line for you actually pulling something off. And so I think it's like always the thing. It's like, you know, if you're a startup, you don't want to compete with your competitors on feature parity. You want to find areas where your competitors just can't even play. And, you know, the one area where the bigger firms can't play as compared to the solo is when you talk to me, you talk like you're talking to the metal. Like, if you're like, hey, can you budge up on valuation 10%? I can just go, yeah. If you're trying to sell the company and you like are in this situation and you're like, I need someone who I can trust that like it'll just come here, you know that I'm not going to distribute that amongst the rest of the team and people are going to trade it for gossip because that's the currency that you need in venture.
Yeah.
And I think that's the... It's like, you know, it's the same advice I would give companies as the advice I try to take myself is just, even when I talk to fans, like I don't take board seats. I don't use like weird instruments. Like I'm just like safes. Like this is a two-way street. But I literally say to people, I'm like, look, if you want to talk like every day, we can talk every day. Like that's fine. if you never want to speak to me again after I make the investment, that is also totally fine. I'm like, I recommend for you, because I do this for myself, find ways of holding yourself accountable. And like, that can be writing a monthly update. That can be doing a quarterly check-in. That can be having like a peer board of founders where you meet up like twice a year and do a like 3-hour session. But like, you know, if you don't trust your investor, like, and it takes a while to build up to that trust, it's hard to have an accountability mechanism that's actually valuable, because like accountability is also being able to be like, I fucked up and this is why. And I think that's like one of the most valuable things you can have in a relationship with an investor, because when you're the CEO of a company, you don't want to give a team, and like, you want your team to believe in you. And there's almost like superhuman belief that's required to be like, hey, we have nothing, but we're going to build something that's like one of the greatest companies the world has ever seen. But then you fuck something up personally and you're like, oh, that this is going to be harder. And so I think that's where like the edge you can have as a solo GP comes in. And it's where I try to kind of position myself in this whole like venture market world.
Yeah, I agree with that. Like, on the angel investing side, for me, it's a similar dynamic, just like not as strong, because like as the angel, you're usually like not a super big ticket in comparison to like an actual fund. But you also talk to them on a different level, right? Because especially like if you're a founder angel or just someone who's like currently running a company, then often like the founders trust you with other things than they might trust their like larger investors with, because they feel that there is not the gossip mill that you talked about, which especially in like Silicon Valley, sometimes in New York, like also in smaller markets, can be an issue that most people are just talking with each other that work with the larger funds. But then also you just want like a trusted source that you can just like talk with when things actually like feel bad or go down. And this is one of the main things that I try to be for the like companies that I invest in. I love it when they're successful, right? That's what I want them to be. I want them to be successful. But where I feel the most honored is if actually something really bad happens and the first person they text or call is me. That is like just an, like such a good feeling that the trust is there. And then you can try to figure it out together. And this is actually something that I also heard about you from someone. I won't name. But I think this is like the highest honor that you can have as an investor, I think, if the founders trust you to actually go to you, even if things are bad. So it's good that you brought it up. One segue that I would like to do is, like, both of us are originally from Europe. Both of us now live in the US, like both in New York as well. But like, I lived in San Francisco for a bit. You, like, when you were at the other venture fund, were spending time in different cities in the US. So let's talk a little bit about the European ecosystem versus the American ecosystem. There are a lot of angles that we can use, but maybe let's just start with the decision of yours to build your fund in New York versus anywhere else.
Yeah, it's a good question. So like I was kind of the end of 20, it was like end of 21. And I sort of came to the conclusion that I was like, okay, I want to go do my own thing. Where do I need to put myself? And I was 29 at the time and I was single. I was like, it's not that you can't be successful in Europe. It's just harder. And I, you know, I had a bunch of friends moving to New York. I'd spent some time in San Francisco in 2021, but it was like literally like bottom. San Francisco was a dark place in late 2021.
I agree.
And I came to this conclusion around New York where I was like, look, like the energy and the people and the willingness to take risks, like it just felt like a better location for me to like try to start my own business, and like my own business being the venture fund. And like, I do, like, I think people also overestimate, like, I think European venture capital is like very competitive, and it's like, there's actually a lot more dollars chasing fewer opportunities, and so things get heard about and circulated like extremely quickly. And I think that makes for like a really tough dynamic where like it's almost impossible to find something that there's not like 15 people already like trying to like hammer cash into. Well, the experience I had in the US was companies raise money, they talk to three or four people, they pick the one out of the three or four best that they like. You know, there's obviously the crazy stuff in San Francisco, but it's not like the total attend. So there was that like bifurcation of, in the US is more competitive, but there's a lot more opportunity. And I think people are just more risk-taking and willing to back young people going for it. And, you know, like my phone one, I kind of joked about this, but like, you know, I grew up in Ireland, spent like 28 years of my life in Ireland. And like my phone one has five times as many LP dollars from Minnesota as I do from all of Ireland. You know, people in the US, like be they institutions or investors, are just like more willing to put risk capital behind young people really going for it. And I really felt that. And I think had I been in Europe, raising the fund would have been much more challenging. And, you know, now when I was raising the fund, I was like, I think I'm going to invest 50% in Europe, 50% in the US. And what's ended up happening is it's closer to like 70-30 in terms of like where the founders are based. But it's actually 50-50 based on nationality, because I'm pretty much the only European VC. Like, I felt like a bit of a hypocrite sometimes when I was living in Europe, and I would say to founders, I'm like, you need to move to the US. You need to move your family. You need to move your kids. You need to go right now. And they'd be like, oh, like, we need to figure it out. And I'd be like, no, like, you need to move right now. Like, this is where the opportunity is. And that's like kind of hypocritical when you're like sitting in Dublin or London being like, but I can do this job very well from here. And, you know, I think I'm, unless I'm wrong, like, I think I'm the only European venture capitalist who like actually was like, okay, I'm going to move to the US and like, I'm going to see how this goes. And I'm going to set up my own firm here. And that just like is another thing that keeps you top of mind for great European founders, because they're like, you should talk to Finn. Like, he's been through the O1 process. He's been through the green card process. He's got that mindset. And I think that's been really valuable. And like the community of Europeans that are coming over here, like everyone you need is like very high quality, because they have that screw loose in their head that was like, it's going to be really hard to get a visa. I'm not going to know anyone, but I don't care. I'm going to figure it out.
That is one of my best deal sources as well on the angel side. It's just Europeans moving to either New York or San Francisco or somewhere in the US. And then similar to you, lots of the conversations start, how do I get the visa? Or they start with, should I go to New York? Should I go to San Francisco? Or they start with, how do I raise from American investors? Is one question that I probably get like 20 times a week. It's like, it's just such a, like, we have asked these questions like ourselves, right? The O1, the green card, all these kinds of things. And then it also at some point like aggregates and multiplies, right? If you've helped, I don't know how many people you've helped come over here, but probably quite a bit. And then their friends at some point might also come over, and then it just multiplies from there. The other thing that I find interesting is the same thing that you said on the VC side is like often very true on the founder side as well. It feels that American VCs on average, and like whenever I say these generalizations, obviously there's some exceptions in the European ecosystem, right? You know that there's like some like people who also take a lot of risk there. But on average, or like even like if you look at like the individual like risk-taking appetite, founders are very frustrated often talking with European investors versus American investors, especially in the early stages, just because the demands of what has to be proven for a European investor is often so high in the early stages that it doesn't make sense, right? And then on the other hand, you have people in the US who actually invest risk capital and invest in founders early on, believing in their vision. Part of that is probably just based on like valuation pressure and how big can the companies actually grow. But I think part of it is also like cultural and like who becomes a VC in Europe versus who becomes a VC in the US. So maybe like as a like just rule, who do you think should stay in Europe on the founder side, and who do you think should take a stab at it in the US? Do you have like some kind of heuristic for that, or is it very case by case?
I think I think it's like less your type of person and more the type of company that you're trying to build.
Yeah.
And like, you know, all of this comes down to ultimately, where are your customers? And secondly, like enough customers to build a really big business, you know, if we're talking about venture. And then a secondary component of it is like, where is the talent that's going to be required for you to build the business to serve those customers? And the third component that people don't talk about as much is like, in terms of the ultimate exit, where are you going to go? Like, US M&A markets are just like materially more mature than European ones. European capital markets on the public side, even though companies have not been going public that often these days, are just materially more mature, and you'll trade at a premium in the US. So it almost doesn't make sense to be listed in Europe. But I think it really does come down to where are all your customers? Like, if you're a software infrastructure company and you're like not in the Bay Area, like that is where like 50% of your early adopter, 50% of your early adopter large customers will be within an hour's drive of Palo Alto. So like, you need to be in Palo Alto. If you're a Revolut or like, you know, even like take, for example, like a PennyLane, where you're like, we are focused on serving French SMEs with like a full stack vertical fintech product. You know, there's questions around like how big can that be? But like, your customers are French SMEs. Like, you need to be as close to the metal with those companies as possible. And the trade-off you're making is like, there is a potential time constraint, but there's only so many things you can be at any point in time. One of the interesting parts around like what's going on in AI right now, I think, for European founders is, you know, there's this whole idea of like, sell the work, not the software, and that like AI is going to expose like more kind of like workforce and labor budgets to technology spend than we even had in the past around IT. And I think the interesting thing for European markets is like, that opens up, if that's correct, much larger TAMs within European ecosystem. So, you know, I have an investment in a team based in Berlin that are focused on like, they see AI workers for the German healthcare market. The German healthcare market is the second largest healthcare market in the world after the US. And if you can like really capture like even a small percentage of the total labor spend in that market, that can be an enormous business. And so you could get being like, oh, I should be in the US, I should be there. I'm like, where are your customers? How big is that market? You know, I have a similar investment in the Nordics in the accounting space where they're like, look, we want to be the biggest accounting and finance platform in the Nordics. And I'm like, be close to your customers, stay in Copenhagen. I have another business that does remote patient monitoring. So like camera systems in like senior care homes, hospitals. And for them, the challenge is you're not as big a TAM. It's not accountants. It's not healthcare systems, doctors, orthodontists, dentists. It's specifically senior living facilities and sometimes, you know, hospital wards. You know, after consideration and like going live in Denmark, going live in Switzerland, going live in the UK, they realized they were like, actually, the massive market opportunity for this is the US. And so we're going to keep our engineering team in Copenhagen and we're all like, you know, go to market's going to be in the US. And so I think it's like, there's no size fits all, but it's the real deciding factor on like, where are the most of my aligned customers that I'm going to be able to sell into that I can build a really big business. That's generally how I feel about it now. And if the answer is all of my customers are in the US, the like, when can you move is like, the answer is yes. Like, the answer is always yesterday. Cause like, you and me both know this. Like, when you first come here, like, building networks in the US is actually like, it's not impossible. Like, you can do it, but it takes time. And, you know, suddenly you've met that person at that dinner, you've met them again, and then they're like, oh, Mike, I should invite you to this thing. And then you're trying to get in touch with the customer and you're like, oh, hey, do you actually know this person? And it all starts to compound. But there's no way to like accelerate trust building in a new network. And the like first step is actually being here full time. Because if you're not here full time, if you're like, oh, I'm just saying for like 60 days on ESTA, people just don't take you seriously. They're like, cool, you're a person, travels, has a good time, like, see you later.
Yeah, I agree with what you said, like, especially in the first one, like, you should be where your customers are. Like, nowadays, like, companies can be built remotely way more easily, but ultimately being close to the customers, sometimes even whether it's time zone, right, that's time zone is the first step, but then, like, physical presence is, like, the second step. It's just so much easier to get, like, actual big deals done, to understand your customers, because you do not only want to sell to them, you also want to spend time with them, right? And that is severely limited when you're not physically where your customers are, or like definitely also if you're not in the same time zone, because life is just different. And then, yeah, building a network and compounding, I think it definitely takes time. But one of the nice things about both New York and San Francisco, which is the only U.S. cities where I've lived in L.A. for a bit, but that was mostly for college, I feel that it takes a little time, but also people are very open to just meeting new people and forming new relationships. And one of the cheat codes, like at least for the Europeans who move here, it's similar for people from like India or China or something, is first step, just like meet some people from your own country or from Europe. Like you always have like a little bit of like a trust level. If like, for example, when we met, right? We were like immediately bonding over just like, oh, we moved here like from different countries in Europe, but like there's some shared like shared journey, shared culture. So like this is the like the first wedge in, and then it should expand from there. Don't only hang out with like people from your own country or like from Europe. But I think that's usually like a little bit of a softer cushion for some people who move over. That's like spending time with the expat founder community, like the, like one of the few expat VCs there is like here in US as well. One thing that I really wanted to focus this conversation on, because you had a LinkedIn post about that a while ago, and then some people reposted it as well, is the difference in terms of compensation, like employee compensation in Europe versus the US. Because like we talked about like different appetite for risk taking, right? Like in the US, like usually a bit more risk prone. I think most Europeans would even agree with that. Even the European funds, they like more solid investments and their returns are often good, right? But they just think about it a bit differently. And then similarly, there seems to be like a big issue with like talent in Europe, because we do have a lot of talent. We have a lot of smart people all over, like lots of smart engineers, lots of just very smart people on the business side as well. But it seems that they are not aggregating in tech as much as they are here in the US. And there's multiple reasons for it. And one of the things that you were talking about, like, I don't know, like must have been a couple of months ago, was that Revolut only mints 29 millionaires. There was like some kind of like post about it.
I wrote that when I was actually on the plane to Slush in 2021 originally.
Yeah.
Because I saw this Sifted article where it was like, oh, Klarna valued at 45 billion, prints 25 millionaires. And I was just like, prints like maybe 75 millionaires.
Something like that, yeah.
But I was like, that's crazy for a 45 billion company to only produce that many. And there's like certain details in the accounting and people were like, oh, it's like this. And, you know, this is like what's been exercised, blah, blah, blah. And then obviously, like, actually, it probably will print no millionaires because of all the recaps and restructuring, which is also like just the reality of company building and tech. But I think every time I've ever negotiated with, like, you know, an employee or like helped a company negotiate with an employee in Europe, there's kind of a perception that the equity has no value.
Mm-hmm.
While in the Europe, because they haven't seen examples of other people who have joined startups and done incredibly well. And while like Silicon Valley and even like New York to a lesser extent, and Boston, like actually to a bigger extent, there are just so many people who've made so much money from joining a company early. And like not even joining like in the first five employees, like, you know, if you join Google in the first 1,000, if you join Facebook in the first 1,000, if you join Coinbase in the first like 300, like you did unbelievably well. And I think that that's the challenge. And like the reason I wrote that article was because like people don't do themselves any favors. Like a lot of optional programs that people set up for their companies are like hyper unfriendly to employees. Like, you know, the exercise periods are like super short. So it's like, hey, if you leave and you don't have all the money to pay all the tax on this, like, fuck you. Like, you're not going to get your equity. A lot of them don't have like double trigger vesting. So it's like, if you get acquired, you roll into the vesting schedule of the acquirer, and then like they fire you and you just lose your shares. And you're like, well, that was a waste of time. And so I think there's just like the ethos around compensation on the equity side is like, if the acknowledgement is that like, it's probably not worth anything, then like, you have to tell the story of why it is. Like, you have to make it an attractive package to bring people in. But I honestly don't see a fix for that until someone like Revolut goes public. And then all of these people in London are like driving around and now Bentleys and like buying up all of the apartments. Like, damn, I mean, if they're still living by that new office in Canary Wharf. But I think it's a real... That's like the missing fire in the European ecosystem. And I think like companies like UiPath produced like some wealth, but it wasn't as much as you would think. The Skype mafia, that was like one of the big early exits in European tech, they all actually did make a lot of money, and that was hugely accretive. And so, you know, you don't need a lot of these things, but I think you do need a couple of them to start moving, or else, you know, you just really struggle to get the momentum.
Yeah, and this is like there's two things that I have thought about quite a bit. Like, number one is like the compensation structure in general, but like the second thing that you said, I would like to start with, because this is, I think, one of the main reasons why the US ecosystem is so far ahead. Right, it started a bit earlier. It also had like more large exits, which then meant that people who have done it before either started new companies or built the funds, like the VC funds that then invest in them, or like angel invested in like new founders. So like, it's a very much a flywheel effect, right? If you have exits in a specific country and it is distributed that like the employees also have like a significant portion of that, then that means that there's more new ventures coming and more appetite for like doing something like this again, which is why these like big exits are so important. And then the other part of it is, I would agree that like the perception of equity is usually different. And it depends a little on the countries as well, because like some countries have some like very unfriendly tax treatment of these equity packages. I'm not like a great expert on like the specific countries, but I know that there's like some big differences, at least compared to the US here, where you have like some very favorable tax treatment of the equity options that you can use here. The other thing that comes on top of the equity is also just salaries, right? Because like here in the US, like salaries, even at startups, are significantly higher. And in tech in general are just like higher than they are in Europe, right? In Europe, you have like a huge gap between startup salaries and what you can earn at a consulting or a finance firm, which is something that I assume a mutual friend of ours, but definitely someone who reposted your earlier post, like Lauren Rothwell posted about it, that like a lot of her very smart friends in the UK, they just end up in finance because you just earn 4 or 5 times the salary than like what you would get at an early stage startup. And whereas you can make more money, like in terms of like salary and bonus potentially at like a finance or a consulting firm here in the US, you can still make like a decent salary at the earlier stage startup. So do you agree that this is also an issue, or do you think most of it is like more on the equity side?
The challenge is like you can't have it both ways. Like, you know, it's like if you're being generous on equity comp, like salary comp, and like you're also comping people like they want to go into finance. Like, I agree, like US startups pay more than European startups. Like, you know, that's just a fact. But it's also like that their cost of capital is lower. And so, you know, a typical European pre-seed might be 1.5 million, while a typical US pre-seed might be 3. Like, you know, but they'll be expected to kind of deliver on the same timeline. And I think there's like the cultural thing is like people would put aside the lower salary if they believed in the risk and the equity upside.
Mm.
Don't believe it. And so like, the short-term comp, like one of the things that I think actually this is a good example of Revolut doing really well is there are lots of people that can't move from London or can't move from Berlin, and for various reasons, family, otherwise, like they don't want to start companies, but they want to work at a great company where people take their work very seriously. And that's the biggest opportunity in Europe right now, is like you create the place where people go to do very serious work. And, you know, I think Revolut really capitalized on this in London, whereby, you know, people were like mix of psycho, like, you know, people get fired in meetings, like, you know, everyone is in the office all the time. But I'm like, for a certain type of person, like, I don't want to work at a company where like we don't fire the people that aren't doing anything or like aren't pulling their weight. Like, I don't want to work at a company that people go in at 9 a.m, leave at 5 p.m, take 25 days of annual leave, take 6 days of sick day, and like don't reply to emails after, you know, 6 p.m. Like, you know, if you're in the period of your life where you want to get great work done, you need to be surrounded by other people that want to do great work. And I think that's really hard because in Europe, it's counter to the culture. But I think that's the biggest opportunity to build companies in Europe right now, is have that like very strong culture. And a lot of people try to build it, and then the first adversity they suffer, where they have a really good engineer who just will only come in at 9, will always leave at 5, and is uncontactable. And they're like, oh, but they're really good. And it's like, you just can't sacrifice that. The thing, because once one person is that way inclined, once you lose that intensity and you lose that energy, it's almost impossible to build it back.
Yeah. I have a fun story about that, actually. We, like, at our last company, basically, at the company, like, both of the companies, we had, like, a six-day work policy. Like, we started with that from the very, I mean, in the very beginning, we worked 7 days a week, everyone in the company. Like, the first couple hires and us, we were just, like, basically just working out, sleeping, eating. That was basically it. At some point, we decided that, like, employees, at least, should, like, have a day off, and it was, like, a decision that was, like, it wasn't an easy decision back then because we were in Silicon Valley. We were in like super hardcore, we have to do this mode. That was when we were building the fintech. And then we kept the like 6 day work policy for everyone, like basically the entire time of the company until we sold the assets then. And what we learned is that it made hiring much more difficult, especially because we also hired some people. Like we had a split office between San Francisco and Berlin, a little like the, I think the Danish company you mentioned earlier, where some of our engineering was in Berlin and some of the team was in San Francisco. And then the decision that we had to make is like, do we hire this like very good person, but they just don't want to work Saturdays, right? And it wasn't an easy decision, but we then ultimately just decided not to do it because it would just like change the culture too significantly. And that meant that like a huge pool of people we just couldn't hire, but at the same time that the people we hired were aligned with the way we want to do our work. And that doesn't mean that if you're sick, take a day off, obviously, right? Or if you need a break, whatever. But it's just about like setting the standard. And the thing that like people then sometimes say is, well, like that sounds like everyone is overworking, but you never force anyone, right? They can just work somewhere else. Like if the expectation is just that you have like a certain level, and it's like still healthy to a degree, then I think that's just what you should be able to do, which sometimes is also difficult with European labor laws, just mentioning that. But
No, for sure. And I think like one of the tying all of this together, like that culture only works when people feel like owners. And so you have to work 6 days, you know, you're working 6 days a week, this is what we're doing, but also like you get a terrible equity package and we're paying you peanuts.
Yeah.
It's like, all of these things have to make sense in the aggregate.
Yeah.
And I show it's like people shouldn't, if you have to force people to work 6 days a week, then like you also have problems. But like all of these people working in GS or Morgan Stanley, like they're working crazy hours anyway. They want to be part of an environment where they can succeed and actually break out. And so I think that to me is like, and it's hard, like it's a really, really hard thing to do. But like, there's a reason why the best companies in the world are like this, because like, once you like catch the tiger by the tail, like it will try to fucking throw you off like constantly. And as soon as you allow this sort of like creep of laziness or creep of like culture, your grip softens and it's gone. And you know this from like previous, I know this from previous companies. Once you lose it, it's the worst thing ever because you're like, oh.
It's so difficult to rebuild. And by the way, like we paid like both very well on the salary and on the equity side. Like we compensated people for the like additional work more or less. And I think you have to do it if you want, like if you want the right, if you want the best people, then you need to be generous, like with like at least the equity. Like I think overspending on equity, like this is also what I always tell my, like basically most of the companies that like I talk to, like my founder friends, whether it's like people in the US, people in Europe. In the US, it's a bit more established. Like you want people, as you said, to feel like owners, like the first employees. Like it needs to continue like forever, basically. I think everyone should be an owner of the company if they work at the company full time. But like especially early on, these people are so fundamental to your journey that they need to feel like they're an active part of the journey. So I think that's like a pretty strong one. Maybe like to close it off, since we are like heading towards the time limit. You have seen so many different founders, right? You've done it in Europe, you've done it in the US. What is something that you are like extremely excited about, just about the future? Like what just like really gets you going? I think that's always like a great way to like end this. You can like, it can be whatever you want.
It's interesting. I think we're in this like very paradoxical environment right now, where the world is becoming more chaotic. You know, Pakistan and India are potentially going to war, like Ukraine and Russia is like, you know, a conflict that like doesn't seem like there's a near-term resolution. You know, there's the trade issues in the US, and, you know, also like social issues around like different parties across the world. And yet on the flip side, like we've never seen like the potential for so much value creation from technology. And I think like one of the things that sort of inspires me is like economic opportunity is the biggest driver of avoided political instability. Like all political instability, revolutionary movements, right-wing movements come from economic dissatisfaction in their people. And I think that there's a real opportunity with AI and robotics and space and like novel energy transmission to like pull humanity like really far forward into the future in a way that, like, you know, I'm talking about like the 2004 to 2014 leap rather than the 2014 leap to 2024 leap. Like we are now back in a, like, in 2034 things could be so different that if you took someone from today and put them there, they would be like, what the hell is going on? And I think like the hardest part of that is like it's not as clear what that future is going to be. And there's a lot more uncertainty in the wider world. But if you're someone with like a real mission and the wherewithal to build a great company, there's never been more capital, there's never been more available resources. Like even in the nichest corners, like you can build businesses for like the tiniest group of people imaginable. Or you can take mega swings and, like, you know, try to build the future of like space-based data centers, the future of like human companionship. I think that's what, it's hard to know. Like, I'm not the person, like, if I was starting companies, like we started this quantum computing company and incubated it because I was just like, this is like such a unique situation that I don't know if I'm going to be able to find the team working on it. But like quickly, I want to find founders that I sit down with and I'm like, wow, I've never thought about it that way. That's so awesome. And those are the people you want to back. And I think there's going to be more and more of those people. There's just also going to be a lot of noise. Whether you're joining a company, trying to start a company, that's going to be the important thing to figure out what to be able to filter.
I think that was a perfect way to end it. Finn, thank you so much for your time and all the insights.
Oh, thanks so much, Mike. This was great.
Free audio post-production by Alphonic.com.